Welcome to Spill Radio. This program is being recorded on the traditional, ancestral, and unceded territory of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh people. I am Tatiana Melema, hosting this program on behalf of the Morris and Helen Belkin Art Gallery at the University of British Columbia. Spill Radio is presented in collaboration with CITR 101.9 FM with sound production and editing by Joshua Stevenson. Today's episode will include my conversation with Carolina Caicedo, whose piece Serpent River Book in the exhibition Spill gathers images and texts from her work in the Colombian, Brazilian, and Mexican communities affected by the industrialization and privatization of river systems. Caicedo is an artist and activist involved in territorial resistance and solidarity economies sustained through community projects and housing as a human right, contributing to the construction of environmental historical memory as a way of preventing violence against human and non-human entities. Her work generates debate about the future of shared resources, environmental justice, and cultural biodiversity. Since 2012, she has developed Be Damned, a body of work that focuses on communities affected by extractivist industries. Her work has been exhibited worldwide, and she's an active member of the Los Angeles Tenants Union and the Rios Vivos Colombia Social Movement.
I'm really interested in speaking today about your work and in particular your ongoing project, Be Damned, that investigates the effects of large dams on the natural and social landscapes in several American bioregions. And I know that this is a major work that's ongoing and it includes in a constellation of artworks, but I wonder if we could begin with a bit of an introduction to this project and maybe how it first came about.
Yeah, so in 2012, I learned that the most important Colombian river, the Magdalena River or the Yuma River, was getting dammed. And this dam was being built by a transnational company called Endesa Enel. And it was the first dam at that point that transnational capital was building in Colombia. And I was particularly interested in knowing more about this infrastructure that was being built, because during my teenage years, I grew up on a river town on the Magdalena River, not exactly where the dam was being built, but close by. So, you know, it kind of touched my personal history and started researching, and then found out that there was a lot of opposition to the dam, and that actually a person that I knew was doing activism and supporting the struggles of local communities in the region where the dam was being built. So through that person, his name is Jonathan Luna, I had the chance to travel for the first time and visit and start building relationships with people on the ground who were resisting the dam, mostly fisher folk, artisanal miners, so peasants of small plots of land or who were working in crops that were not their own, but, you know, that would provide the muscle work for those crops, and started getting more involved. So this was how I started, and this kind of opened for me a possibility of work that could engage with environmental issues. So I've always been interested in kind of social justice issues as a mother, as a woman of color, as an immigrant. I left Colombia in 1999. Of course, I must say, an immigrant with privileges, of course, but this was actually the first time that, you know, that I started researching with this environmental focus, or even this environmental justice focus more specifically, because there's many ways of kind of embodying and enacting environmentalism. You have a more Western way that we can think about in terms of conservation, for example. And then you have, you know, kind of Southern epistemologies that have to do with more with so like environmental justice, environmental racism, ecofeminism, indigenous epistemologies and understanding of the territories. So this opened for me a whole realm of interests and also looking back. So this was in 2012. Looking back also, it kind of reconnected me with Colombia. I had been away for a long time, and though I had touched issues of immigration and have had kind of returned to do certain exhibitions, to actually start researching and working with communities on the ground there reconnected me and kind of rooted me there again. And I guess I was longing for that because I kind of dived, you know, head first into that.
Can you describe a bit what your process was in sort of those early works for the BDAM project? I know that you really integrate a sort of specific research methodology into your artistic process. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, the first ones were like field work and being, you know, in the place is always an important part, and collecting testimonies, both oral and visual testimonies. So understanding that not only human entities can provide a testimony, but also the body of a river and how it starts to change, you know, it is a testimony if you think about it. And I started to understand since the beginning that this damming was not only a direct affectation on the body of the river itself, but also on a social body that depended and that was interrelated to the river. So since the beginning, I understood it as a layered conflict, if you want to think it about it that way, that had environmental implications, but that had cultural, social, economic, spiritual implications too. The first kind of set of works work more as analogies, visual analogies between the damming itself of the river, you know, and the damming as a containing of that flow of water, and making a visual analogy with other forms of social containment. So, for example, images of riot police breaking a protest, for example, or kettling people in the street, for example. So a very straight visual analogy between damming and social containment. And the first set of works function a lot within that kind of pairing. And there's a lot of, pairing and dichotomy in terms of formality. So you see a lot of diptychs in that first series of works.
I know that also in some of your other works, you've actually presented images of rivers upside down. And I think of that as also this gesture. Can you speak a bit about the significance of a gesture like that? What does it engage to turn something upside down or to sort of produce these kind of physical barriers within an exhibition space?
Through the project of fieldwork and research, I've developed very strong relationships with people on the ground, because I guess my approach to understanding and accessing information is not scientific or purely anthropological, in a sense that I want to remain neutral or outside the issue itself. All the contrary, I implicate myself completely, you know, and become part of resistant processes through art making. As part of that implication, you know, there's the building of relationships and friendships. A very important person in this whole project is a woman that lives in La Jagua. She's a fisherwoman. Her name is Soyla Ninco. And in the first interview I did Soyla, the first time I visited is in El Quimbo Affectation Area. She told me that when she went out to protest, she would carry the Colombian flag upside down. And any person who has been involved in protests in the public space have probably seen this gesture. You know, you carry the flag upside down to denote that you're not in agreement with the actual government, no? So she told me, I always carry the flag upside down because, you know, because we elect our representatives to administer our common goods, not to sell them away, which is what is happening in our case with El Quimbo. You know, they sold the river away. And that really stuck to me. So when I came back to the editing table and I was editing, I was like, I want to protest. What happens if I, you know, put the river through editing upside down to mimic this gesture that Soyla was talking about? And when I did that, that really like blew me away in the sense that opened a realm of formal and theoretical possibilities in relationship to ideas of landscape, for example, and Western formats of gaze, right? So if we think about how we're trained in the art world, we have different, like two main formats, landscape and portrait, right? And landscape has traditionally, historically been the way that we, format we use to represent what we call nature, right? But landscape, if you think about it, is really a window through which the human, the observer, positions itself outside of nature, right? It's a window through which we look at a set of relationships, but we are not there. We're watching, kind of looking through this format to something that's outside of us or that we are not in. And also it positions ourselves in a superior position too, no? The position of superiority, human superiority. And this is a very Western gaze, right? And it has been a gaze of the colony, you know, it's a colonial gaze. So when I turned the river upside down, I understood that, how complicit as artists we can be of processes of colonialism, and that it was important for me to start unlearning those given formats that I had been trained in. And that maybe instead of trying to kind of represent nature through landscape, maybe I started to think how to portray that body of water, under the understanding that a river is a political subject with agency, right? It has the power to change a circumstance. You know, if the river floods, something is going to happen. If the river dries, something is going to happen. So it is an entity, a political entity with agency. You know, the rivers, the forests, the stones, the minerals, the air. Those decisions of playing with given formats and traditional ways of kind of representing a river has to do with processes of unlearning and the decolonization of the gaze.
It seems to feed into your work that's in the exhibition for Spill, Serpent River book. And I know that this book can be opened and pleated and read in many directions. So again, I see the sort of play on this format as a political gesture. What is the significance of the format of the Serpent River book for you and the materials within it?
Actually, when I was in Berlin, in this early stages of the process, and I started researching about waterways and the construction of river channels, dams, and looking at more historical documents, I pulled out of the Federal Archives in Berlin this map of water pipes that cross the Berlin Wall, both from the east to the west Berlin and back and forth. And the format of the book was this accordion fold with pleats that when you pleated, it actually kind of completed the perimeter of the Berlin Wall. So actually, the format of the book is coming out of this map. So it comes out of something I found in research, of course, research related to waterways and the control of water. The book is a way to look back at all the material compiled during those 5 years of research, fieldwork, and art production, and think about how these personal archives that we construct as artists that are very unique, no? Because we have different methodologies. Some are more scientific, but some are more intuitive. Some have to do with actually decolonial ways of access and information. So how to present this material without presenting like a solid and closed conclusion. So I wanted to make a book that instead of working as a catalog or presentation of my results, actually could provide an opening of those results and kind of shoot into many directions and be used in many ways. And I also thought that I wanted to make a publication that could function in many contexts. First and foremost, in the context of the same communities that I have been working with, and that's why you will find the book that on its upper side is very visual, thinking about all these people I've met throughout fieldwork that perhaps have many, many different ways of knowledge and skills. For me, it was important to make a book that anyone could access, you know, that you didn't have to have reading skills to be able to access and understand and find narratives within the book. And then the texts that are included are very easy texts too. They're very poetic. So there's a selection of poems. There's selections of myths of origin. I think perhaps the most essay-like text has to do with fishing nets. So any fisher folk can can access really that text. And I also wanted to make a book that worked well as a traditional book that you could sit down and flip through it and read it, or that could work as an installation, like a more kind of contemplation object, as you probably the public will access it in Spill, in the exhibition at Belkin. But that also could be a workshop resource or a performance score. So we've been activating it as a through performance in different scenarios. The Serpent River book is also responding to a very important Amazonian belief that is the Cobra Grande, or the big snake. And in the majority of the Amazon, both indigenous and peasant and mestizo communities believe that the Amazon, the great river, and all its little branches, smaller rivers and streams and whatnot, are inhabited by the Cobra Grande, by the big snake. And this is an entity, of course, it's a sacred entity that you know, as humans, we can never really completely understand. It surpasses us, no? But it's this the soul of the river, if you want to think about it that way. So for me, it's a way of portraying, as best as I can, that soul of the river.
I wonder if you could speak a bit about this term geochoreography that you use in your practice and how you've included this in your work. Yeah.
So when I started entering into relationships with people on the ground and resisting environmental injustice and whatnot, they already, you know, it's amazing the level of political sophistication and awareness that rural communities and people on the front line of environmental conflict have, no? So I always arrive into a community that is organized and, you know, politically active in many ways, you know, both in direct action and legal action and education to other members of the community. I could see how the body was being used as a political tool in this extraordinary actions of, for example, blocking the construction, but also in everyday, you know, actions. Because when you continue to fish in a river that's been privatized and that there's no longer fish, for example, because that's one of the main consequences of building a dam, is that the fish population basically disappear. When you continue to embody this accumulated knowledge and to fish, this everyday gesture becomes politicized, right? Or staying in your home when your territory has been declared as eminent domain or for public utility. That's the name we give it in Colombia, you know, and the dislocation or the dispossession is imminent. You have to move for the public good, and staying at your home and continuing to grow the garden becomes a politicized act. It's always been political, right? But it acquires, you know, a more kind of active dimension or urgent dimension. That's where the term geochoreography comes up. And I think about the geochoreography as a set of everyday actions that are intrinsic to a specific geography, plus those extraordinary actions that you do because you are in resistance and you are in disagreement and you're trying to survive and protect a way of life. I think Be Damned and art can really nurture ideological, political, educational process, you know, because being in the front line is really hard. People get killed for that. People are getting killed all over the world and fined, imprisoned, right? So as artists, we're not in the front line, or maybe certain artists are, but I'm definitely not in the front line. But I do like to think that I'm immediately behind, kind of, you know, helping to hold that front line. And I also think that, you know, in the authoritarian kind of spell we are in at the moment, all ideologies have a visual wing. And we can see that with corporate media and, you know, the rubbish produced by Hollywood. And I think, you know, as artists that, you know, our skills are constructing and deconstructing images. I think we have an important role in counteracting this more neo-fascist visuals that are popping all around us. So I think, and art institutions have that role too, no? Of course, and that responsibility, because that's where we operate. We operate in the visual field. So how can we counteract this neo-fascist and oppressive systems of gaze, of production of images, and how can we support political processes on the ground?
You've been listening to Spill Radio.